From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorelott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz joins me to discuss an expansion of government surveillance in France that critics compare to the Patriot Act here in the U.S. And we'll also talk about African child migrants and draw comparisons to similar issues at the U.S.-Mexican border.
Yes, these are coming from a number of different countries, but the largest majority is coming from the country of Eritrea, which is situated between Sudan and Ethiopia, a very poor region.
Then Rebecca talks with Trinity University political scientist Suzanne Siavoshi. She spent her career studying an Iranian cleric who almost became the country's supreme leader.
He didn't go public, even though you could hear certain things about his dismay at the treatment of depopulation, freedom of expression, etc.
The Forgotten Ayatollah, right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelott. Rebecca Cruz, let's start in France, where this week they passed their version, basically, of the Patriot Act. Now, the French have always been critical of such security measures in the United States, but coming on the heels of their terrorist incident several months ago at Charlie Hebdo, 12 people were killed, and the subsequent shooting at the grocery store, the kosher grocery store, where 5 people were killed, there was this need to respond, right? So now they've got these broad surveillance powers the French government does, tapping cell phones, reading emails, bugging rooms and cars. How are they making sense of this in France, given their longtime criticism of this kind of activity?
Well, as you say, it's a response to some of the events of late, and this is what many may consider a natural reaction, that the country, the community is feeling insecure and that they can put in these measures to feel more secure, and the government can do this. Interestingly enough, this passed the French National Assembly with a great deal of support. So 438 for and only 86 against. It'll now go to the upper house, but they're not figuring that there will be a problem there. And then the public doesn't seem to be crying or upset about this in any measure. So a lot of support. What's interesting is that this is coming at the same time that in the United States, a federal court of appeals came out and said that the NSA wiretapping that we heard so much about a couple years ago that the French were very angry about because we were tapping some of their politicians. A court came out and said that that was illegal under the Patriot Act. And in fact, our own Patriot Act, sections of that, very significant sections, will be going into sunset this July, this summer. So those will be diminishing. So as we are kind of loosening up somewhat after our own situation at 9/11, where we tightened up our security, we're now beginning to loosen up. France seems to be going in the other direction as they've been dealing with some of these things more immediately.
All right. Well, off to another part of the world. Let's look at children, unaccompanied minors migrating from Africa to Europe. Now, this reminds us a lot of what we've seen in recent years on the U.S.-Mexican border, where Central American children are showing up unaccompanied by an adult. But we have children as young as 8, and there are tens of thousands of these children that are finding their way from various African countries to Libya, basically, where they're being detained. But some of them are making them across. And I think they say about 10% of the migrants crossing the Mediterranean to Italy are now children traveling alone. Smugglers obviously playing a role. This is really a sad shame.
Very sad. And unfortunately, we know that many of those boats that are crossing the Mediterranean do not make it. And thousands have died in the last 4 or 5 years trying to cross over. What's interesting is, yes, these are coming from a number of different countries, but the largest majority is coming from the country of Eritrea, which is situated between Sudan and Ethiopia, a very poor region. They have had what we would call a dictator for the last 20 years. They gained independence in 1993, have not had an election since. And Human Rights Watch came out and said that this is one of the worst places in terms of human rights abuses. So a number of people are leaving. And one of the abuses that they're most concerned about is mandatory military conscription for women and men when they hit 18. And there's no end date to this conscription. And so they are not only going into the military, they're having to take part in infrastructural buildings and city development. And so this is akin to slave labor. And a lot of young people are seeing this, what will happen to them in the future. So they are either leaving or their parents are
sending them. Yeah, their parents,
yes,
are paying money, obviously, to send them off and try to get them into Europe. But at the age,
yes,
of 8.
Well, and parents that don't have money to begin with are somehow finding money. And yes, traffickers are getting involved. So smugglers are helping, but then traffickers are getting involved and holding these children ransom. Oftentimes, they're ending up, as you said, in Libya. If they're lucky, they try to get across. But Eritrea to Libya is a long ways, and it's a very dangerous situation. So yes, very, very sad.
All right, Rebecca. Well, thank you so much for being here, as always.
Thank you.
If you have any questions for me or Rebecca, leave them in the comments section of the Worldviews page at kgou.org. We're also on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, and you can contact each of us individually at Suzette Gorlot and at Cruz226. Next, Rebecca talks with Trinity University political scientist Suzanne Siavoshi about a high-ranking Iranian cleric who had a falling out with the Islamic Republic's leadership 25 years ago. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Our guest this half hour is Suzanne Siavoshi. She's a political scientist at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, and has spent her career studying Iran both before and after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Her latest project is a book manuscript called Dissident Ayatollah, The Life and Thought of Hossein Ali Montazeri. She spoke with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
Suzanne Siavoshi, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
What I thought we would do is start off by talking about an Ayatollah that you have written a great deal about, Ayatollah Montazeri. And this was a gentleman who was very influential during the Iranian Revolution and in the 1980s. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about him and why you're so intrigued about this man and why you've written so much about him.
Well, I am very interested in him, or was, and still is, actually, because of his attitude and his behavior. He came from a humble background, and he was the first person in his family who went to seminary, religious seminary. He was a straight shooter, and from the very, very early on, he actually get on the nerve of his teachers by constantly bombarding them with questions. And he was also a revolutionary. He really helped. He was, after Khomeini was exiled, it was he, meaning Montazeri, who really became his deputy in some ways, revolutionary deputy in Iran. But and as a result of that, he was imprisoned, incarcerated, tortured, along with his son. Then after the revolution, he both, because of his activities, revolutionary activities, and his jurisprudential knowledge, he climbed a ladder of power. And by 1985, he became the successor to Ayatollah Khomeini as the supreme leader.
So he was in line to take over.
He actually was selected officially to be the successor of Ayatollah Khomeini by the Assembly of Experts. And he was in that position for 4 years. But because of his criticism of state policies, particularly about the war, and
the war between Iraq and Iran.
Also about the treatment of prisoners. He did those criticisms early on in closed circuit. He didn't go public, even though you could hear certain things about his dismay at the treatment of generally the population, freedom of expression, etc. So he made some mild complaint publicly, but it was really after the end of the war that he gave. And the end of the war more or less coincided with the 10th year anniversary of the revolution. And he gave a talk in that during that ceremony or during those days where he criticized the prolongation of the war. And he basically said that most of the war was for naught. And therefore, in the mind of the conservative, he undermined the sacrifices of all these martyrs. You know, more than 500,000 Iranians were killed during the war or died as a result of complication of chemical use of chemical weapon by Saddam's army. And he also very much attacked the treatment of political prisoners. There was a mass execution of some political prisoners related, connected to Mujahideen Khalq, who were the main exiled opposition guerrilla group who also were involved in terrorist action against Iranian inside Iran and sided with Saddam. And they actually, after the war ended, they came in to Iran and with an army. And that both enraged the state, including Khomeini, and also made them feel insecure that maybe, you know, they want to topple the state. So there was rounding up of many people, many of them innocent, but they were all supposedly connected to this organization. And then there was an order to execute a lot of them. Montazeri became a very ardent critic of that. And that basically was his ending.
He had to have known that this would be the result. If he was going to be so vocal against the state,
right,
and by extension then Khomeini, that this would not bode well for his
right.
political aspirations right. if he had them.
Right. It was a combination of factors. I mean, things built up from very early on. People knew that he was a straight shooter, but people thought that he might just sort of be on the side, not to interfere so much in politics, but he couldn't. I mean, he was a man who was very interested in justice. And that's what made me intrigued with him. Mm-hmm. And so when he was basically dismissed from his position, then he felt free to basically become an official dissident, if you wish. But another thing that really intrigued me about him was this tension within him. Because on the one hand, he was a traditional jurisprudent, and he was very much attached to the old conservative way of thinking about life and about the role of religion. On the other hand, the experience with the Islamic Republic made him to rethink many of his positions. And as a result of that, he became a dissident. And he started to rethink his position about certain rules of Islam. And as a result of that, he became one of the ardent clerical supporter of democracy and in some ways human rights, I would say.
That's Suzanne Siavoshi, who teaches and studies political science at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. She's an expert on Iran's sometimes confusing political system. We'll hear more of her conversation with our contributor Rebecca Cruz right after this short break. I'm Suzette Gorelat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelat, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This half hour, we're hearing from Suzanne Siavoshi, a political scientist at Trinity University. She's working on a book manuscript called Dissident Ayatollah, The Life and Thought of Hossein Ali Montazeri. Just before the break, she told our contributor Rebecca Cruz how Montazeri's growing criticism of Iran during its decade-long war with Iraq in the 1980s eventually led to his ouster as the designated successor to Ayatollah Khomeini.
So Khomeini passes away, and although he had been in line to be the new supreme leader, he was no longer in that position, and a new supreme leader was put in place, Khomeini. And what had been their relationship? Did he feel more comfortable with Khomeini's rule, or was that also a situation where he felt he needed to be a dissident, as you said?
By the way, let me just make one thing clear, and that he was dismissed while Khomeini was alive, the supreme leader. And then Khomeini was appointed supreme leader. And when he became the supreme leader, Khomeini, the first supreme leader, was the teacher of Montazeri. So the relationship between the two is an interesting one. And Montazeri loved Khomeini and revered him, but then they started to have their disagreement about policies. Khomeini, on the other hand, was student of Montazeri. At least he took some courses with Montazeri. So the relationship was the opposite. And during the negotiation or discussion years earlier that whether Montazeri should be the supreme leader, the next supreme leader, Khamenei was one of those who supported him. But then later on, when he became the supreme leader, their relationship started to become very sour. And I would say that Montazeri had much better relationship with Khomeini than he eventually had with Khomeini. In fact, Khomeini in 1997, after Montazeri attacked him for his credential, that he doesn't have the credential to be neither either the supreme leader or the source of emulation for all Shiite, gave a talk. And right after that, Montazeri was put under house arrest for 4 years. So the relationship was really fraught with tension and I would say anger and animosity.
And one incident dealing with another leader of Iran, Ahmadinejad, Montazeri came out and said that he was very much against the policies of Ahmadinejad in regards to the nuclear buildup, which, of course, has caused concerns over here. He passed away in 2009, and Ahmadinejad is obviously no longer in power in Iran, is no longer president. And there's a new president in Iran who seems to, at least from the West point of view, be a little bit more liberal and more open to human rights and those sorts of concerns. Is this policy more in line with what Montazeri was thinking?
Absolutely. And I would say Montazeri would go further. Because if you compare Rouhani with Khatami, the president, the first liberal president of Iran, Khatami was much more liberal than Rouhani. Rouhani is pragmatic. He's very savvy. But Khatami had all the ideas that, as you said, in the West, we agree with. But Montazeri really eventually, at the end of Khatami's administration, started to criticize Khatami for not being able to bring up or satisfied, fulfill the promises that he made. So he was on the left of Khatami in some ways as far as practice were concerned. And so I would say that he would urge Rouhani to be more assertive.
To do
in pushing.
Even more.
Yes, I would say that.
Okay. One of the other issues that you've done a lot of research on and obviously a lived experience is the idea of gender in Iran and relations between men and women.
Well, there are several ways of looking at this. One is on the legal, institutional, constitutional way. The other one is really what's happening on the ground. If you look at the position of women in terms of health care and in terms of education, Iran has made huge progress in that way. Even the rapporteur of United Nations in his report in 2014 mentioned that. But then again, there are areas that women are basically pushed back, and these are mostly on the legal terms, particularly in family laws and penal code and etc. that create a tremendous number of obstacles for women to assert themselves. And so there are discriminatory laws against women. And those laws are still there. And although some things have changed, for example, let me backtrack for a second. After the revolution, the family law, which was pro-women, were shelved, and a new law based on the traditional interpretation of Islam was put in its place that actually undermined all the achievement of women and put them back. But things change a little bit, especially due to the effort of many women. So there were some changes in the family law. But overall, the family law is still very much against women, discriminatory against women. But I can talk a little bit about specifics of it, if you wish. For example, the issue of the age of marriage. According to the traditional Islamic jurisprudence, the age for many of these clerics was 9 years old. But through the effort of people, particularly during Khatami, the parliament passed certain law, and the age was moved from 9 to 13. In terms of custody, for example, the boys were under the custody. If there was a divorce, the mother will have custody over their sons for 2 years and over the daughters for 7 years. And then that would go to the father. But now it's 7 years for both children. Of course, these are not enough. And there are a lot of voices in Iran that are pushing for more. Still, I would say that the position of women and the position and the position of liberals or those who are for democratic reform are very much meshed here. I mean, they're connected, interconnected. If there is a backlash against democracy, there is also a backlash against women. So there is a women movement in Iran, but its fate is very much connected to the fate of those who are pushing for democracy in Iran, I would say.
A very complex issue for sure. Well, thank you so much for coming and sharing with us some of the history of Iran and the political leaders there and of course, the situation with women in Iran as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Rebecca Cruz's conversation with Trinity University political scientist Suzanne Siavoshi. This conversation is archived on our website, kgou.org, where you can also subscribe to our weekly podcast. It's also available in iTunes. Worldviews is a production of KGOU with support from the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our research fellow is Symphony Swift, and Brian Hardzinski produces the show and oversees our digital content. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorelott.